Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we're going to be reading part 3 of Miracles Cast in Blood by Jarrett. I hope you are enjoying this story so far. Let's get started. She couldn't believe this. She knew Dennis Randall was scum, but kidnapping the son of your own probation officer and using it as leverage to extort him? That went beyond her wildest dreams. It sounded like a thriller novel, not real life, and yet here, Charlie Sanders sat across from her, weeping in his hands. The sound bothered her. She considered reaching out a hand to offer her a supporting touch, but no. This demanded professionalism to the fullest extent. "Look," she began. He looked up. "I'm sorry. I should have known something was wrong, but I didn't. I..." He wiped his eyes with his sleeve. "No, I should have told you. I wasn't going to, but, well..." "Does Dennis know you've spoken to me?" "Yes, well, under the pretext of planting the drugs." "So, at best, we have, say, a few days?"
"Until he finds out? Yeah, probably."
She inhaled sharply. "I'm going to bag these as evidence." She reached a hand in her desk, slipped on latex gloves, and retrieved two clear plastic evidence bags. One for the photo, one for the drugs. Carefully, she bagged them, dated them with a marker, and then set them aside. For the moment, as soon as this conversation was over, she'd have the crime lab go to work. Fingerprints, DNA, anything connecting Dennis Randall to them.
"Okay, here's what we're going to do. Charlie, I need you to focus."
She peeled off the gloves and pointed to her eyes with her index and middle finger.
"I want you to know I'll do everything I can to save your son. But right now, we need to take steps to make sure he doesn't hurt him. That's imperative. Because it'll buy us a little more time."
How are we going to do that?"
"You're his mole, his insurance policy, so to speak. I intend to keep you working with him."
"What? Why?" Jessica wondered briefly about that. A probation officer should be smarter than this. Well, when considering his current mental state, it wasn't all that surprising.
"Because I need to know what he's up to. You need to keep feeding him enough to keep him from getting suspicious. The second he thinks you're up to something, he takes it out on your son. I don't want that. But just know that we're going to have to make it convincing."
"Make what convincing?" She smirked. It was the first time all day she'd smiled.
"I think I found a way to buy your son more time."
Dennis soaked the yellow sponge into the cold water and wrung it out in his hands. The flesh of the goddess twitched and spasmed in the red light overhanging the bathtub. Her skin couldn't handle the UV rays, so he kept her in this basement all chained up unless he needed her to perform a miracle. He still couldn't believe where he'd found her. He'd never tell a soul, of course, for the goddess was his and only his. No one else drank from the well of her power without his say-so. He ran the sponge across the flesh of her back, if one could call it a back, the chains rattling as she jerked away. It sure didn't look like any back he'd ever seen. Regular people who caught a glimpse of the goddess probably thought she was a hideous beast, a revolting creature that should be killed. The unthinkable. If anyone tried to hurt her, he'd be there, ready for them. Marjorie reached out to brush a strand of hair from her daughter's pale face, her fingers stiff as they hovered just inches above Lizzie's forehead. She didn't make contact, didn't dare disturb the fragile stillness. Tom stood at the foot of the bed, his arms crossed tightly over his chest. His tie hung loosely around his neck, his blazer discarded in a crumpled heap on the nearby counter. He hadn't spoken for a while, and when he finally did, his voice was strained. "She's going to wake up, right?" he asked, his gaze fixed on the monitor tracking Lizzie's vitals. "This isn't permanent, is it?" Marjorie shook her head, though she wasn't sure who she was trying to reassure.
"The doctor said the seizures have stopped for now. They're keeping her sedated, giving her brain a chance to rest."
Her voice was hanging on by its fingertips. Tom's jaw tightened.
"And then what? You just take her home and pretend everything's fine?"
"No," Marjorie snapped, her voice rising before she caught herself. She took a deep breath, pressing her fingers to her temples.
We'll figure it out.
The hours drug on, an endless torment that neither of them could handle. Marjorie excused herself to the bathroom, leaving Tom alone with Lizzie. He rose and clutched her hand gently in his. How had everything gone to crap so quickly? Only last year he'd been on top of his game. Now he was staring down the barrel of being fired, his daughter unable to function, and his wife on the edge of drawing up divorce papers. And to think of how high he'd been riding before all of this had been thrown in his lap. He'd written some demanding exposés in his time. But what truly thrust Tom Harrington's journalism into the national spotlight and changed the trajectory of his life was his cover of the Silver Pines Siege. He was only 30 when he stumbled onto the story, in 1988 while working as a staff writer for the Sentinel, a regional Wisconsin paper with modest circulation and a menial budget. He'd received a tip from homesteader Dwight Elkins, who lived on the outskirts of a sprawling property deep in the Wisconsin wilderness. Elkins was an old hunting buddy with Tom's father, so he had spilled the beans to him. It had begun with a discreet phone conversation. Tom found the cryptic, out of the blue nature of the intriguing, though didn't have any big expectations going in. Figured it was just another story. He knew all too well that Elkins was no fan of the federal government, but quickly found out that he was even less enamored by his new neighbors, a militia group calling themselves, rather obtusely, the Pine Guard. Yet there was nothing obtuse about their leader, Caleb Matheson. Tom quickly learned the man to be charismatic, an effective organizer, but also dangerous. The heart of his message could be boiled down to protecting American freedoms and preserving an old, simple way of country living, interspersed with radical religious beliefs. Elkins suspected there was something else going on and talked Tom into sitting down with him.
Look, I can prove it. Don't ask for no evidence or nothing, because I got none.
The old man had muttered to Tom over coffee.
But I'm guessing it's all illegal stuff, by the way they're acting. I saw a crate of machine guns and grenades. Hey, and there was something else.
What? Tom asked. The old man shook his head.
I don't know, but they carried it into the house, seemed real reverent about it, and whatever it was. Like they worshipped it or something.
Worshipped? What do you mean? Was it a person?
I don't know. Didn't look like no person. All I saw was a lump under a blanket. Never got a peek underneath. All I know is they're gearing up for something, Tom. I can feel it.
To his credit, Tom was skeptical at first. Perhaps as many would be. Rumors about militias were common in the Midwest, where anti-government sentiment had quietly simmered after years of a stagnant economy and poor job prospects. Yet something harbored deep inside Elkin's tone. The man seemed genuinely fearful. So Tom agreed to start looking into it. He'd started small, reaching out to local officials, combing through land records and interviewing anyone who had a connection to Caleb Matheson, or his quote-unquote militia. His early findings were onerous, but fruitful. The Pine Guard was more than a harmless group of survivalists. They were a growing paramilitary organization with ties to larger militia networks across the United States. They preached anti-government rhetoric, practiced live fire drills, and most concerning of all, appeared to be acquiring an arsenal of illegal weapons. To do what was anyone's guess? What sealed it for Tom was an anonymous tip from a former Pine Guard member who had defected after Caleb's erratic behavior made him fear for his life. The source provided Tom with detailed descriptions of the group's activities, as well as a manifest of the weapons they'd stockpiled, some of which had been modified to circumvent federal law. They seemed intent on defending something, and that meant that anyone who wandered too far from their property would wind up on the receiving end of a bullet. Whatever the thing was that they were guarding, Tom never found out. He stood at a crossroads. He could publish his findings and let the chips fall where they may, or he could take his evidence to federal authorities. One winter day in late December, the decision was made for him. A couple of local teenagers had wandered too far onto the compound's property. They wound up shot dead. No warning, just two shots from a bolt-action hunting rifle. Bizarrely, the hearts of both boys had been removed. Only gaping holes remained. Neither the shooter nor the butcher were ever identified. Yet the murders tipped off the FBI and ATF. Tom hadn't wanted to provide them with the evidence or information he'd gathered, but he wasn't about to be slapped with an obstruction of justice charge. The alphabet agencies moved quickly, securing a warrant to search the Matheson compound for their illegal weapons. On a frigid morning in February 1990, federal agents surrounded the property. Caleb Matheson ordered his followers to resist to their dying breath, and resist they did. The standoff lasted a week, with tensions escalating to their breaking point. Caleb delivered fiery speeches to the press through a megaphone, painting the federal agents as tyrants. Inside the compound, fear and desperation consumed the Pine Guard members. On the second to last day, a firefight erupted in the thralls of a whiteout blizzard. By the time the smoke cleared, 7 militia members were dead, but Caleb remained standing despite taking shrapnel in his leg. The open wound festered into a nasty infection, with the man not having much time left, unless he surrendered and underwent medical care. On the other side, 2 federal agents had gotten their brains splattered in the snow. One might think the remaining compound members were swiftly led away in handcuffs, but this was not to be. Reports conflicted, but what is clear is that a fire broke out, igniting the house and turning it into a raging inferno. Tom had gotten his hands on images of the feds barricading the doors and sealing the windows shut, trapping the members inside, though many dismissed them as doctored fakes and the government denied it. In the end, all 51 members who'd survived the shootout burned to death inside. Tom's investigative reporting, published under the headline, "The Militia Next Door," detailed the group's activities. Caleb's descent into paranoia, the stockpiling of illegal weapons, and the controversial government response. It was lauded as a masterclass in investigative journalism, earning Tom widespread recognition and eventually a Pulitzer Prize nomination. As the years wore on, more details emerged, and Tom couldn't drop a bone, not with this much meat left on it. So he kept writing and began to criticize Jackie Matheson. In his reporting, Tom painted her as Caleb's right hand, fully complicit in the malicious activities. But as the years passed, new accounts suggested a more complicated picture. She may have been a reluctant participant, coerced by Caleb's dominance in the cult-like atmosphere of the group. And something else. Some unknown puzzle piece that had never quite fit. He'd been offered major jobs at every big paper in the country. The Times, the Post, even the San Francisco Chronicle. Marjorie hadn't wanted to move, saying that it would uproot Lizzie. She had only been in elementary school at the time, but he wanted, no, demanded, that his career take precedence. The fight seemed never-ending, but eventually Tom caved. It caused a rift that had never fully closed, wounds that had never quit oozing. And now, well into 1998, Tom was stuck at the Sentinel. Granted, he was a lead reporter now, but never again would he reach those journalistic heights. He was destined for a career of mediocrity. He had flown too close to the sun and gotten burned. He squeezed Lizzie's cold hand tighter. The fingers remained motionless. Just then, he heard footsteps behind him and Marjorie returned, a paper cup of coffee in her hand. Steam billowed from the brim as she handed it to him. "Here," she said. "I thought you could use it." He took it appreciatively and drank. The liquid burned his tongue. Marjorie sat down in the bedside recliner and held her head in her hands, her elbows propped on her knees. "Are we bad parents?" she asked. Tom felt jolted by the question and walked to her side, placing his cup down on a nearby table, accidentally slopping the brown liquid over the side, spilling a small puddle on the wood. He left it. "What do you mean by that?"
"I don't know. I just feel like we've let her down somehow."
He couldn't answer, his tongue locked in reticence. The guilt threatened to bury him. She went on.
"Sometimes I wonder what would have happened had we been there. Maybe things would have turned out differently."
She sighed and rubbed her temples in circular patterns. Tom put a hand on her bony shoulder. "There's no point in asking what if. What's done is done. The only thing asking what if does is torture you. And we've been through enough torture." She looked up at him, a melancholy smile passing over her lips, like dry leaves on a windy fall day. She reached up and clutched his hand in hers, nuzzling the side of her cheek.
"I know we have, but she's still going through it. You can't move on until she does."
They both looked over at their daughter, a plethora of tubes and wires running from her body to numerous beeping instruments.
"I'm sorry," he said. She looked at him.
"For what?"
"For what I said to you in the car. I didn't mean that. It was crappy and cruel, and you didn't deserve to hear any of it."
"For what it's worth, I feel the same. I'm sorry for hitting you. I don't know what came over me. I just...
"I do. You were protecting Lizzie. You're the best mother she could have ever asked for." He heard her suck in a sniffle and then felt warm, wet droplets on his hand. He looked down and noticed her crying. He took her in his arms and held her quaking body as she sobbed against him. Joey looked down at his frail, emaciated legs and wondered if he'd ever walk again. How long had he been tied down to this bed for? He wasn't sure. Movement caught his attention. His eyes followed a fat old man as he waddled next to Dennis, then stopped before the blanket-swathed goddess.
"What did you say you got?" Dennis asked.
"Parkinson's," the throaty voice replied.
"You?
Nah." Dennis playfully slapped the man's heavy gut.
"Let's just get this done,"
the fat man said. Dennis threw his hands up.
All right, damn.
He gave him a stern look. "Turn your back."
"What? Why, you said..."
"It doesn't matter what I said. She doesn't like you. She can't perform miracles if she doesn't like looking at you."
"This weird thing? She isn't a thing. She's the goddess. You worship her."
"Yeah, thing, goddess, whatever. Just do it."
He handed Dennis a hearty ball of hundreds. Dennis gave a cursory examination, then shoved the wad into his pocket. He asked the man to turn his back, and when he did, Dennis ripped off the blanket. Joey knew better than to look. Any glimpse and she would infest your mind, make you go crazy. The effects rarely, if ever, wore off. For Joey, seeing the goddess one time had given him nightmares that still hadn't subsided. Even recalling past memories turned into a torturous foray. So he shut his eyes as tight as he could and listened to the all too familiar rattle of chains. But this time they came closer, right on top of him. He could feel their approach, their growing proximity.
"Keep your eyes shut. Turn around to face her," Dennis commanded to the man.
Joey heard a gruff exhale of breath.
"Now unbutton your shirt,"
the rustling of fabric.
"All right, now she's going to touch you. Brace yourself."
Suddenly, the man began to scream. If Joey's hands were free, he would have shoved his fingers in his ears. After too long a time, the screaming subsided, replaced by heavy, labored panting.
"You good?"
Dennis snickered. The man gave a terse "yeah" in reply.
"It's over?"
"Yes, sir. Don't offer no guarantees or nothing, but your next checkup will be squeaky clean."
"All right, what now?"
"She's got to get wrung out. As is tradition, you get to pick."
"Didn't you already?"
"Yeah, I guess I did. His daddy ain't playing tonight, so I got to punish the kid too. How would I say, incentivize him to do better?"
The fat man laughed.
"You should cut me in on this. I don't like that blonde whore either. She staged the whole stunt to get back at you through Sanders."
"I know, but you're too connected. How'd you find out about that anyway?"
He chuckled. "I have my ways. Various connections I've made over the years. But if you must know, her paralegal ratted her out to me. She eavesdropped in the hallway, and since she clerked for me in law school, she let me know. She is, after all, a customer of yours."
Dennis smiled.
"Ah, yeah, you're talking about that blonde Abigail girl. Yeah, I took her daughter's leukemia. I remember."
He scratched his chin, then turned and said to Joey,
"You ain't gonna like this. Oh, it'll be your first time, but I imagine you'd rather have Parkinson's than have your pecker cut off."
The rattling of chains drew closer than ever before. Joey winced, his eyelids throbbing from the effort of sealing them.
"Come on, get up,"
Dennis said to the goddess. Joey heard squelching flesh, squeaking mattress springs, then felt a horrid, rotten residue drip onto his naked body, like snot from a sick child. Vomit tore past his esophagus, but the duct tape gave the bile nowhere to go but back down, scorching his throat all the way. He felt the goddess mount him, her wrinkled, sagging flesh cloaking him in loose clumps. He squirmed, tried to buck, to kick out, but the bondage kept him in place. Dennis leaned in close and whispered in Joey's ears,
"Squirm all you want, it won't matter."
Joey felt the goddess's orifice open wide, too wide. He could sense the circular rows of suckers from inside the mouth expand, readying a strike. Finally, the cavernous jaws slammed down towards onto Joey's chest. A massive red flash bloomed in his skull as it began. The suckers punctured his flesh as blood gushed forth. Joey Sanders screamed. I hope you enjoyed that part. Hang around for the next one. That will be, whenever it releases. But I would love it if you'd subscribe for more and follow on Spotify.
And if you'd like to support the channel and to keep these stories going forward, well, head on over to Patreon. I really would appreciate that. And thank you to my patrons for being patrons. It really does mean the most. If you'd like to come hang out with us on Discord, you can do so. Links to all of these things and more will be in the description. Check them out if you want to. If you don't, well, all the power to you. Either way, we'll see you in the next one. Take care now. Bye-bye then.